Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Colin Bennett, who is the author of Flying Saucers Over the White House, The Inside Story of Captain Edward J. Rupert, and his official U.S. Air Force investigation of UFOs. This is a fascinating book. As many of you know, I spent 13 years in the military in the Air Force, and much of the story here is something I can relate to. I was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and that was a kind of a hotbed of UFO activity, including reports coming in now and again of live aliens, people seeing live aliens. So I knew the Air Force was involved with this. I had never known the detail to which is reported in Flying Saucers Over the White House regarding Project Blue Book and some of the more interesting historical facts about this era in history. Welcome, Colin. Thank you for joining us from London. Is that right? You're from
Thank you for your invitation.
Well, I guess we can start by asking you how you got interested in this topic.
I said, the story of Captain Edward Rupert interested me. I was a writer on UFOs. I've written a book on George Adamski called Looking for Orthon. Am I loud and clear?
Sure.
Am I loud and clear?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Oh, well, fine. And the story of Operation Blue Book, Project Blue Book is part of Air Force history, but you won't find it in any official academic historical.
Because it.
Yes, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Pause. 3, 2, 1. I continue. It
yes.
seems a bit of suppressed history, made more interesting by the fact that it's an official. It was an official U.S. Air Force dimension with great historical trail back into the past of American military history. Captain Edward Rupert was a bombardier navigator on Tinian Island in the Pacific during the war for 1945. And Tinian Island was a main base for the assault on the Japanese mainland. The B-29 bomber wings were based there, and indeed it was a buzz of a place to be in because the two nuclear weapons were being prepared. Rupert himself, if there'd been an accident or influenza, might well have been chosen to be the bombardier navigator in place in the bomb bay of Enola Gay, the B-29, which took off from Tinian to bomb Hiroshima. So he's the kind of man who always had a brush with high history. He couldn't help it. When you're so near to tremendous historical events, then you never forget it. He was branded with this closeness, which continued right throughout his life. You okay with this?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. I'll continue.
Please do.
Yeah. And as we know, after Enola Gay took off, a few days later, Boxcar, another B-29, carried, I think it was called Fat Man nuclear weapon, to Nagasaki. So
right.
He's that close to history. And after the war, after the war was over in late 1945, Rupert, an enlisted man, became part of the American aircraft industry. As was to be expected, he was a high technical person. And the B-29s went one way, Rupert went the other. The B-29 squadron, I think it was 509th Squadron, went to, guess what, Roswell, Air Force Base, in 45. There they had brand new B-29s and waited for the issue of the first pre-war production line nuclear weapons. I want to say here and now, I'm not recommending nuclear weapons as a good thing. I'm talking about the history of these things.
Right.
509s waited for the new B-29s with new equipment, and indeed the issue of the first line of nuclear weapons from a post-war production line. And of course, we know that Roswell was later to become a legendary place in UFO lore because of the books that had been written saying that a UFO landed and aliens dead and alive were taken from this crash to Roswell Air Force Base, and where there was some devilish chicanery brought about when there are accusations of replacing alien debris with balloon fragments. You can read this story in books by Stanton Friedman. Very good books on the Roswell legend. All right, back to Ruppelt and his job in American airports. American aircraft industry. Well, he was happy there for a few years until the Korean War came along. And he was enlisted again He was enlisted again and resumed duty at ATIC. That's Air Technical Intelligence Command at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where he said you indeed had seen service. At Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, his first job was to examine crashed at MiG-15, the Russian fighter, which was beating the Sabre F-86 fighter in the Korean War. The Sabre was a very fine fighter aircraft, but it needed a really good pilot to face up to the MiG-15. MiG-15 was brought to Wright-Patterson, where Ruppelt was instrumental in examining everything about it, taking it apart. And he was very successful in doing. Am I loud and clear?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Whilst he was at his desk, he was in an office with several desks with different missions there. This of course is 52, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he was intrigued by the gales of laughter coming from a desk, three desks down from him. It was very annoying, this laughter, and he often wondered what they were laughing at. And they were silly, rather supercilious people, young officers, who were obviously having a good time laughing at somebody. He later found out that this group of officers was laughing at something. It may have been the first time he heard the word, called the UFO.
Mm-hmm.
This officer, I think his name was Rogers, was making a hash of the whole business. The project was called Grudge. Project Grudge, which by its name, you can imagine how much enthusiasm went into naming it. The Air Force didn't like the UFO at all. But since there were so many sightings from highly qualified people, they had to go through the motions of making a kind of mock program with a complete idiot in charge. And this is the cause of the gales of laughter. The gales of laughter were heard and noted by the Commander-in-Chief of Intelligence, Colonel Rosengarten. And there was a report by Bob Gina of Life magazine that the UFO project was being fouled up, deliberately being downgraded and laughed at. Colonel Rosengarten decided that this had to change, And he then got rid of Rogers and his laughing team and replaced it by a much more capable officer, Cummings. Cummings decided to recruit, on a part-time basis, Rupert, who was still on the MiG-15, but the project on the MiG-15 was now downgrading, and Rupert didn't have all that much to do. So he worked with Cummings on the project, which is now called Project New Grudge. And working with this officer, Rupert tried at least to put UFO reports and technical information on a proper scientific and engineering basis, keeping proper records. Mm-hmm. What had prompted this new appointment was that Bob Gina of Life magazine had exposed the Air Force as not dealing with the UFO situation seriously. And therefore, new grudge was formed with Cummings and Rupert in charge.
Mm-hmm.
The results of this new approach to the UFO was that, as I said, these reports were now filtered properly, recorded properly, registered properly, and were subjected to a kind of scientific analysis that was within the narrow, very narrow resources of Project New Grudge. With two men, it was an amazingly difficult task for two men. Remember that we were in the pre-computer age. Am I loud and clear?
Yes.
Okay. I'll say that occasionally to make sure
okay,
that
no,
the contact's
fine.
Not being lost. Okay, 3, 2, 1, resume.
Mm-hmm.
Colonel Rosengarten was so impressed with Rupert's work that he decided to form yet another project with better finance and better resources than Project New Grudge. Cummings passed to other dimensions within ATIC, and Rupert was appointed commander of Project Blue Book and given a staff of 8, 9, sometimes 10 people, which was more, of course, than he'd ever had, and adequate, not great, adequate finances to travel and to interview people and to gather evidence, which, was, of course, was expensive. Given his new command, Rupert engaged what were then quite sophisticated technical horizons with regard to analysis of UFO information. I have to remember that the electric computer, digital computer, had not arrived completely in service organizations. It was still dependent on punch card methods, which was slow and inefficient, but nevertheless were the only means of assessing statistical information. He got in touch with the Bataille Institute, and this may not sound much, and submitted the punch card records of a wide range of UFO observation statistics. This may not sound much in a modern age, 50 years later, or 60 years later, really. But at that time, it was the only thing you could do for statistical analysis. The statistical analysis turned out to be quite significant. It pointed out that there was an area of experience which appeared to fit certain parameters of reality. For instance, not the first thing was that to show was that UFO sightings ran right across the American population. Truck drivers, scientists, fighter pilots, bomber pilots, farmers working in fields, they all saw these strange objects we call UFOs in the sky. It was quite significant. So the social thing was widespread. That's number one. Number two was that the social spread throughout the world was astonishingly widespread. And so the conclusion was, within Blue Book, that they didn't know what the UFOs represented, but they were real. They bounced off radar signals, all kinds of radio signals, gave interference. They maneuvered intelligently and appeared to be mainly in the form of silver discs. The speed of the discs and the maneuvers were phenomenal. No one had ever seen anything like it before. These discs would go from a standing start to something like Mach 3, MAH. Yeah? From a standing start, I mean, there were no aircraft of that time could even match anything like Mach 3. The Air Force in 1952 did not have a supersonic aircraft in squadron service. Jaeger tells us that he penetrated the sound barrier in the Bell X-1 rocket, which was a very experimental vehicle, which only Jaeger could fly. But that wasn't a squadron. The Bell X-1 don't think ever reached squadron service, for goodness sake. And the pilots were very thankful that it didn't. And so highly technical aircraft, their performance was somewhat primitive, to say the least, compared with these strange objects which were reported from all over the world, from all over the United States, right across the social spectrum. What were they? This Ruppelt addressed himself to this question. No one knew. No one had any kind of intellectual, philosophical approach to such an incredible anomaly, such an incredible contradiction to science, technology, and just about everything else. Am I coming through loud and clear?
You are.
Am I loud and clear?
Yes, you are. Sounds good.
Am I loud and clear?
You are loud and clear.
Okay, I'll continue. Okay, so this is the problem. But the first time, at least, that the United States had a project with highly qualified Air Force personnel which gathered this information, and at least, if there was no solution, then the phenomenon of the UFO was being at least approached scientifically. This is his first achievement. The second, however, he did note that in the history of UFO investigations, something mysterious and strange was happening. He found that evidence was being actively destroyed by some very, very high up people. Now, the shelves of libraries groan with the number of books about conspiracy theory and the U.S. Air Force. But Ruppelt did produce some evidence in his book. He did write a book, by the way, called History of the Unidentified Flying Object, after he left the Air Force. That he found that General Vanderbilt, who was Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force in 1946, had destroyed the report of the Project Sign, which was entitled Report on the Situation. Project Sign had concluded that UFOs, this is in 46, 47, that UFOs were interplanetary. This is quite a statement for such an early period. And Vanderbilt destroyed this report. Why he destroyed the report and didn't just write nonsense across it and file it, no one knows. He was a highly decorated person, one of the top men in the Air Force, and he destroyed an intelligence report, which is extraordinary, quite extraordinary.
It is.
For a man of that rank to do such a thing. He could have been court-martialed. He could have been stripped of his medals. It was an act of an enemy. And why did he do this and risk his reputation? And another man of great repute was Colonel Watson, who was one of the number one fighter pilots in World War II. Remember that Vandenberg and Colonel Watson, they were no mean men. They fought through the air war throughout Europe. They were American patriots to a fault. And Colonel Watson, a little later than Vandenberg's action, actively destroyed the White Sands UFO film and also destroyed a wire recording of the Cabal meeting about UFOs. why such men risked shame doing such a thing is very strange. They were American patriots, not Russian spies. And they both had 5 inches of Air Force medals on their chests. And their actions were inexplicable. This call, their actions were found out, however. You couldn't do anything about it. But it's led to theories, particularly in the exopolitical area, that these two people did what they did because they were told by aliens to do so. And they wanted to suppress evidence of alien presence on planet Earth. Now, I don't know whether that alien presence on planet Earth is real or not, but there are whole areas of exopolitics which tell us, or try to tell us, that the aliens are here, they've been here for a long time, they're influencing government decisions. This is called the exopolitical view. And
right.
A lot of people put forward this idea that the exopolitical view was the cause of the actions of Vandenberg and Watson. It wasn't called exopolitics in those days, but lots of people now are of the opinion that these two noble men, they were noble men, they were heroes, they're American heroes. There's nothing wrong with them. They were great people. Why suddenly did they turn and destroy these intelligence records, which could have seen them in the brig, quite frankly, with their reputation in tatters? Okay. Am I loud and clear?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Am I loud and clear?
You are loud and clear.
Okay. Okay, so at the same time as he was putting forward a proper perspective, technical, scientific perspective from the Air Force itself, he was coming across a lot of opposition. He found that his project couldn't be expanded, and they wouldn't give him any more money. And the reports were being filed, but not in a proper way. You need a lot more personnel, a lot more money in order to advance Project Blue Book. And there was change of bosses at ATIC, Air Technical Intelligence Command, and they were of the same opinion that the Blue Book, I think the word to Rupert might have used, Blue Book was hobbled, H-O-B-B-L-E-D, like a horse. Yeah, so it couldn't go too fast. In other words, Rupert was producing the goods, and this would not do because the Air Force was against the UFO in every way, and it would put every kind of obstacle in Rupert's way. This was the situation, and Rupert noted this. He couldn't do anything about it, but continued with his reports. He didn't know where some of them landed up, probably in the waste bin, but he kept careful records. And the records, by the way, are there for all time. They're there. They're there in Air Force annals. This is the situation. Just a moment, let me think here. Yeah. In July, '52, an extraordinary thing happened in Washington, over in the Washington skies. Now, before I go on to that, One, two, three, break. I'm just going to have a sip of water. Is that okay
sure,
with you?
No problem.
While Rupelt was in Dayton, Ohio, doing his thing with Operation Blue Book, an astonishing thing occurred in the skies over Washington, D.C. The Washington, D.C. has three airports. Well, in those days, it had three airports. Washington, in those days, in 52, had three airfields. The first one was the National Airport, which handled the civilian traffic in Washington. The other was Andrews Air Force Base, which flew F-94 night fighters. And the third one was Boeing Airfield, which I think at that time didn't have any operational aircraft. I think it was more an administrative and training base. Anyway, well, back to Washington National Airport on the night of Saturday night of July the 19th, 1952. Glowing orbs, about seven of them, approached Washington airspace, which, of course, even in those days was restricted, to say the least. About the military and the entire Capitol building was restricted. No one should fly there without permission. However, these three orbs, what I can only call glowing orbs, several of them approached Washington and exhibited enormous changes in behavior. At first, these orbs, which I don't think I can call them anything else, these orbs were at very low speed, which was the first piece of information observed about them. The speeds were in the region of 100 to 130 miles an hour, far too slow for jet aircraft. There were no jet aircraft in the region, and far too slow even for civilian aircraft, unannounced civilian aircraft, that is, like the Convair Constellation, which is a regular passenger prop aircraft, propeller aircraft, that used popular for civilian traffic. What were these orbs? No one knew. The chief controller, I'll say it again, the chief controller of Washington National Airport was Howard Barnes, very experienced man, and his radar, he's a big radar manned by top professionals at Washington National Airport. His radar registered these orbs as starting to increase speed and doing maneuvers. He knew he was looking at something strange and got in touch straight away with Andrews Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
Would you scramble in interceptors? Andrews Air Force Base, believed it or not, said, "We have no interceptors." Why? Because the runways are being repaired. This is one of those mysteries, the kind of mystery that comes out of the 9/11 situation many years
really?
Later.
No fighters available on the East Coast.
I'm sorry, Judy, would you say that again?
Nope. During 9/11, there were no fighter aircrafts available.
Exactly.
To be scrambled.
And on this night,
big mystery.
And UFOs over it. There were no aircraft, no fighters available. Now, let's just consider what that means. Here's the Capitol building, yeah? Here's the Senate and Congress. Here's the President, Truman, asleep in his bed probably.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no fighter defense over the Capitol. No,
yep.
If the Russians had chosen, it was the Cold War, remember?
Right.
If the Russians had chosen to make a move, it would have been God help America, because they would have done it unopposed.
That's
right. It's like 9/11 again. It's very, very, very strange. It's totally unlike standard fighter procedure. Oh, as you know, you're a member of the ex-member of American Air Force.
I used to sit alert as well, where they could scramble F-15s in 5 minutes.
Yeah. F-18 hornets.
Yeah, alert. You know, over in Louisiana.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's a hornet you're talking about.
And when the jet scrambled, it was one of three things. It was either MiGs from Cuba, low-running drug runner planes, or UFOs. Those were the three things they encountered.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you quite plainly. It's very interesting.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, just say that again.
Go ahead with the story.
I'll go ahead, because you're very... Am I loud and clear to you?
Yes, you are.
Okay. It's very strange. It's one of the great mysteries of our time. The situation in the air on 9/11 is still not... No one's even approached that mystery. Anyway, there's a scratch of stuff on the web. When you have Cheney talking to an operator, talking about something approaching the Pentagon, aircraft is 5 miles away, sir. Do your orders still stand? Cheney says, have you heard anything to the contrary? And so, saying, target at 5 miles, target at 4 miles, bang, yeah. And it's an intriguing piece of tape. Anyway, back to Rupert in 1952. No aircraft were available. And so, Howard Barnes, the chief operator of the Washington National Airport, decided, in his wisdom, to get in touch with Newark Air Force Base, about 100 miles away, send interceptors. Mysterious objects over Washington, maneuvering, could be threatening. Now, as an ex-Air Force woman, you will understand why I asked the question. Where in the American chain of command is a civilian, an untrained civilian, allowed to summon fully armed fighter aircraft? In this country, it's unheard of. It couldn't happen. You'd have to get the Air Force, high Air Force personnel involved in such a phone call. But no, Howard Barnes thinks he's in his right, because Andrews Air Force Base doesn't have any fighters, to summon fighters to protect the capsule. Newark decides to send him aircraft hours late. The F-94 was a pretty humble aircraft, but it was capable of 580 miles an hour. and it arrived hours late, which means probably there were no fighters ready at Newark Air Force Base. When it gets to over Washington, the pilot said, I can't see anything. These glowing orbs switch off like a light bulb in a room. And
right.
Howard Barnes made the observation that he thought that these things in some way were monitoring the VHF communications. Anyway, the F-94, with little fuel left, I don't know how much fuel it had. And to a jet fighter, Newark wasn't all that far away, and had to return to Newark. And so these orbs were left playing by themselves over the capital without a single fighter interfering with their operation. Barnes then decided that there was nothing they could do, because his tower operator, his control tower operator, reported a fiery orange sphere, would you believe, to be seen on the radar and out of the damn window of the control tower. And Boeing reported similar objects, and so did the radar at Andrews Air Force Base. even though it had no fighters to respond. There are mysteries here. Like, as great as in 9/11, it's on a smaller scale than 9/11, obviously, but the mysteries here are rather like the mysteries in 9/11. The commander of Andrews Air Force Base, okay, said his runways were under repair. Why didn't he send at least a flight or a couple of flights to land at the civilian and the civil airport? They had plenty of facilities, and they could have taken their kit over there, and at least the capital would have had fighters ready to defend it on proper runways. This wasn't done. It was just decided that, we don't need it.
It's inconceivable that all the runways were under repair.
Sorry, would you say that again, please?
It's inconceivable that all of the runways were under repair.
Yeah. Yeah, the scheduled repair, and the fighters were all up on us.
Yeah, all under repair at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the entire fighter air force couldn't do anything at Andrews Air Force Base. Why some of them couldn't land at Washington National Airport, which had the fully functioning runways and a big radar complex to handle them, no one will ever know. It was just it left Washington totally defenseless. I mean, goodness me, I don't know what taxpayers at the time thought about this. You know, the hedge didn't roll, of course. There were no dismissals. No, there was no inquiry. But we'll get into that later on.
Mm-hmm.
No inquiry as to why the Air Force, on each UFO occasion, whatever that UFO occasion may be, doesn't appear to be interested in what you have to say or in what the circumstances are.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruppelt came across this time and time again. Bob Gina of Life magazine phoned him up 2 weeks later and said, what's happening about these orbs over Washington, which appeared 2 weeks later? And what's the Air Force doing? And Ruppelt said, in all probability, it's doing nothing. Now, again, conspiracy theories seize on this to say this is most odd, this is very strange. We have intelligence information being destroyed by high-up people. We have no F-94s available over Washington, leaving Washington completely defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
The conspiracy theories have a case that something very strange was up here, as it was in 9/11. I don't know the answer to these questions. Is that there are questions which remain unanswered in history, unanswered in U.S. Air Force history, technological, scientific history, even academic history. You will get a good modern academic history of modern America, and it won't mention that Washington was being threatened by glowing orbs in the night sky.
I never knew that, and I was in the military.
I'm sorry, I'm not picking you up.
Oh, I said I never knew that, and I was actually in the Air Force and studied Air Force history. I never knew that. What's in your book?
What I've just said, in my opinion, is quite true. The thing was that, of course, with flying, this was a Saturday night, July the 19th, 1952, and you can imagine, in a big city such as Washington, there were honeymoon couples in the parks taking taking photographs of these damn things. Crowds were pouring out of cinemas, out of clubs, restaurants, cafes, all looking up at these glowing orbs in the sky, which were performing incredible maneuvers. Photographs, lots of photographs still exist of these orbs over the Capitol building. And even the cats and dogs in the street could have looked up and seen them. Ruppelt, who happened to be in Washington at the time, by accident, was in his hotel room, and he didn't open the window. If he'd opened the window, he could have seen what he was talking about, what he was studying, what he was investigating, but he didn't. And so you've got this NASA observation. And then, of course, the morning after these orbs had appeared, there's two-inch headlines on the press, in the press, with photographs all over, photographs and headlines saying, what the hell are these flying saucers? And there was a terrific row about this. But there were all participants in the row, except one participant, the United States Air Force, which was totally silent about such an incredible phenomenon. It doesn't, this phenomenon, July the 19th, doesn't enter modern history books of either Washington or indeed Greater America. It didn't exist. It was wiped out. The Air Force wouldn't say anything. And moreover, there's an episode in which Rupert, the next morning, went down to get his breakfast, ready for a conference in the Pentagon about other matters, and was immediately mobbed. You're the UFO man. You're the UFO man. And he couldn't, because Project Blue Book was a secret project at the time, he couldn't say much. And he talked to people, but they couldn't get anything out of the Pentagon. The Pentagon press officer, Al Chop, tried to pressure the Pentagon, and said they'd seen nothing. It's making yourself look rather silly. I mean, if I were a public relations officer, I could have found a way out of rather than say nothing, and make the Pentagon look like a bloody fool, quite frankly, if you don't mind me using the expression. But the Pentagon didn't seem to mind being made to look a bloody fool. This is a very strange thing. There was nothing. There was no response. Not even the press officer or anybody else, or the United Press of Washington, could get a statement out of the Pentagon about these amazing UFOs. And Rupert, particularly fed up, didn't get any money for investigations. He didn't know Washington very well. He didn't know the bus service very well. He could not get an official car. He could not get extra money for expenses for travel. He was expected to pay all such things out of his per day allowance. And so fed up and unsupported, Rupert went back to Dayton, Ohio, to continue his Blue Book investigations, and confident that the Pentagon would not support him in any way. How about that? Yeah. It was an Air Force investigation, yet he was not supported by the Pentagon. They tried to make Rupert look a fool by being silent, by trying to gag him. Anyway, the problem for the Pentagon loomed large 2 weeks later, July the 23rd, when the nightmare began for the Pentagon again. Lo, on July the 23rd, objects started appearing above Washington airspace once more. This time, Howard Barnes comes into the feature again. Notice that he's a civilian. There's no military interest. I mean, nobody from Andrews Air Force Base said anything. This is the game the UFOs are maneuvering in the Washington sky.
That is amazing.
Go ahead.
It's an amazing story. It really is.
Yeah. Okay. Howard Barnes is getting fed up with telephoning airfields, Sleepy Hollow airfields, which send him one half-fueled F-94 hours later. He's getting fed up with that. He's getting fed up with no reaction from the military, no reaction from the Pentagon, and therefore he decides to phone Air Defense Command. This Air Defense Command was under direct command at that time of Curtis LeMay, and he knew if Curtis LeMay had the information, he would act quickly. And Excuse me. He, within minutes, two F-94s roared towards Washington. That was the difference. That was under Curtis LeMay's administration.
Right.
These two F-94s go above in the Washington sky. Remember, two F-94s, probably on afterburners, roaring in the late evening of Washington sky, must have been a terrible sound.
Right. Roaring,
you know, I mean, you're an Air Force woman. You know what a jet sounds like on afterburners on top speed.
Yeah.
And again, crowds pouring out of everything you can imagine onto the streets, looking up, photographers, honeymoon couples in the park, photographing them, same thing. These two pilots, probably more aggressive than the previous pilot, decide to give chase. And astonishing things happen. The first pilot says, I'm giving chase. The UFO keeps in front of him in speed, as if it were leading him on. Come on, come on, come on, you want to fight? Come on, come on, you want to fight? Come on. And the F-94 was not a supersonic aircraft by any means. It was quite a humble aircraft compared with the F-16, say. And the pilot was at top speed, racing after the UFO, but the UFO just kept ahead of him, often entering into Mach 1, Mach 2 leaps of speed, which astonished the pilot and told the pilot, indeed, there was nothing much he could do. Now, let's just have a look at the underlining to this Air Force presence here. These were armed fighters. So you've got a situation where the pilots don't know what to do. Should they open fire? That's the thing, you know, open fire. This is restricted airspace. Airspace. Should they open fire? Nobody. Who takes this decision? They go to Barnes again and say, "What action shall we take?" They're asking a civilian operator to open fire on an airborne object, which could, of course, be the first act of the Third World War. Where was the Air Force intelligence? Where were the Air Force staff? Probably asleep in the beds. And it's a shocking episode in U.S. Air Force intelligence. It had its parallels in 9/11. Nobody knows what's going on. The command and control system in 9/11 was chaos. Didn't exist, or it didn't exist. The command and control situation in Washington in 1952 was the same. Chaos. Nobody knowing having any leadership, any command system, any monitoring system. Nobody knew what was giving the fighters orders except a civilian controller in Washington National Airport. They were VHF to him. Nobody else. What shall I do? But Barnes, of course, was a very sane guy, as airport controllers tend to do. And he didn't say, open fire, for God's sake. Otherwise, he could have started World War III. Or, even more mysterious, if these glowing orbs had been made of exotic material, alien material, as some people suggest, and the F-94's machine guns, they didn't have cannon, machine guns, and open fire, you could have had a supernova explosion over the American Capitol. If these glowing orbs had been built of exotic material, you could have had Third World War, or, you know, in what looked like Third World War. Moreover, it later gave endless consideration to one question. If there were solid objects, and they were three-dimensional in the first week, 2 weeks before the event I'm talking about, the radars of Bolling, Andrews Air Force Base, and the National Airport had registered a triangulation, which meant that they were hitting solid objects. And that meant that solid objects were reaching Mach 3 region, M-A-C-H, which, of course, is right against any kind of scientific analysis. Any material object entering Mach 3 region would leave us, at least a sonic boom, or a series of sonic booms. You cannot send material objects into the Mach 1, 2, 3 region, as you know, as an Air Force woman, without leaving sonic booms. So the question was, they didn't leave any sonic booms. And therefore, what kind of material were these orbs made of? But nobody asked these questions. I don't know where the hell Air Force technical intelligence was during this period. But, I mean, I'm an amateur observer. I'm not an Air Force technical intelligence observer. And I'm asking these questions. If I can ask these questions, why can't the American Air Force, who are totally silent?